Amen. Appreciate that, Kenny. So the Bible says that Jesus Christ came to proclaim liberty to the captives. Jesus has come for people who are captive, and he has come to tell them that there is liberty for them. The question is, what does that mean? What is Jesus essentially driving at when he says, I'm coming, I'm preaching, I'm letting you know that there can be liberty to the captives? And to really sort of unpack that, I've got to bore you for like 3 minutes. And I do that a lot. I've bored you a lot longer than that. But I have the decency to tell you this morning that I'm about to do it. And that's the change. But if you look at what Jesus is driving at, the Greek language is more specific than English. So when we translate the Bible into the English, so sometimes there's something lost there because the Greek is more specific, and they have more words than we do. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. So something is lost in translation. And when it says here that Jesus has come for the captives, you might say, well, boy, he's come to do prison reform, right? He's come to preach in the prisons, and he's come to tell prisoners that they can be free. He's come to do social reform. But that's really, I don't think, what's being captured here. And if that's in fact what Jesus did, he didn't seem to do much of it in his ministry. But the word captive here in the Greek language actually means spear. And it's a picture of being a POW. And so in that day and age, if you surrendered, if you lost a battle, they would line you up, and instead of having guns and leading you off, they would have you at the point of the spear. And so the picture here then is of Jesus saying, I have come for the POWs. I have come for those who have been fighting and have been losing. I've come for those who have tried and I have failed. I've come for those who thought that they were going to win but have lost, that are now being held at the point of the spear. But then the question is, well, what does it mean by liberty? So he's coming for the POWs. He's coming for those who have fought and lost. What does he mean by liberty? And it's an interesting word again in the Greek. Are you bored yet? I'm working on it, right. I'm getting you there. It's an interesting word because almost always it's translated not as liberty, but as remission. In fact, there's places here, if you have the Luke passage, gentlemen. It says the next one. I skipped that one, I'm sorry. They said of Jesus that he came to give knowledge of salvation unto his people by the remission of sins, or to libertize people from sin. Next passage. For this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the liberty, it's translated here remission, for the libertizing of sins. Again. Then Peter said unto them, day of Pentecost here, repent and be baptized every one of you in the name of Jesus Christ for the libertizing, or the remission of sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. This word liberty is always used, as far as I can tell in the Bible, in connotation with being delivered from sin, to be libertized from sin. So if you put that together, what Jesus then is saying is that I have come to bring liberty for people who have become captives of sin. They're POWs of what? Of sin. I've come for those who have fought, who have strived, who have thought that they had mastered their life, who thought that they had control of their life, but who have in fact found out that they do not have control, then they have been taken captive by sin. Now, is that substantiated in the Bible? Does sin really take you captive? That's a concept that I don't know that you've thought about. And I want to share with you two places in the Bible where sin is seen as a captive, Sin is seen as something much bigger than that. Sin is seen as an addiction. And look with me, and it'll be on the screen here, in Jeremiah, chapter 2, verse 23. God is talking to the nation of Israel, and it's in a horrible shape. The politics have failed. They're about to be invaded by Babylon. They're about to be conquered. The morals have fallen down. And in spite of everything that's going on in the nation, the people can't stop worshiping idols. Like with all the stuff that is going on where they should be waking up, they're not waking up. And it's interesting, and it would be comical if it wasn't sad, because in verse 23, God is speaking for them, and he says, how can you say, I am not polluted? I have not gone after the Baals or the idols of Baals. See your way in the valley. You know what you have done. Now let me just stop there. He says, how can you say you're not polluted? How can you say we don't have a problem? How can you say there's nothing wrong with us? Sounds like denial, doesn't it? Sounds like denial. We don't have a problem. We're not polluted. I was thinking of my, I shouldn't tell this on my daughter, but she's not here now, so it's one of those things. But I got up, it's probably been 3 years ago. She would have been three, maybe pushing four. I got up in the night to go use the restroom, and I walked by her room, and it stunk. I mean, there's a smell coming out of the room, and I look in, and because the dog sleeps with her, and I thought, that rat, I mean, she's done something under the bed. I turn on the light, and her covers, her blanket, her sheet there, it's the stuff Mike Carroll pumps for a living. And, I'm thinking it's the dog, but the dog has already left the room. He's not there. The smell drove him out. He's gone for another place to sleep. And I turn on the light. She wakes up. As it turned out, she'd eaten watermelon all day and had an accident in the bed. And so she's awake, and I go in our bedroom. It's next door. And I say, honey, she's pooped all in the bed. She pooped in the bed. And that's what you do if you're a husband. You tell your wife, something's wrong. And she's out of the bed, and she's mad, and she's following me, and she's saying, I did not. Now, it wasn't a dog, but mom takes her in the bathroom, and she's cleaning her up. And she looks at my wife and says, who would have done something like this to me? Think about that. Now think about that. Denial. I didn't do it. Nothing happened. Somebody else might have done it, but I did not do this. And Israel saying, we are not polluted. We don't have a problem. There's nothing wrong with us. And God says something very coarse here. And sometimes we try to make the Bible very G-rated. And I'm going to read it and just let it stand the way that God said it. He said, know what you have done. You are a swift dromedary, which is a female camel. Let me find it. Breaking loose in her ways. A wild donkey used to the wilderness that sniffs in the wind in her desire in her time of mating. Who can turn her away? All those who seek her will not weary themselves in her month. They will find her. He's saying, listen, how can you say you don't have a problem? You're like a female camel in heat. I mean, come on. And nobody has to go looking for you. You're easy to find. What's wrong with you? How can you say you're not polluted? But verse 25, he says, withhold your foot from being unshod and your throat from thirst. But you said there is no hope. Now for I have loved aliens or foreign gods, and after them I will go. Now think about that. Verse 23 says, we aren't polluted. We don't have a problem. Complete denial. By verse 25, they say, there's no hope for us. There's absolutely no hope. Denial, very quickly flows into them saying, we're trapped. There's no hope. We're addicted to worshiping idols. And to idols, we're going to go. And there's nothing that can stop us from doing it because there's no hope for us. Now, that's a picture of sin. That's a picture of sin. And by the way, when you think of ancient Israel, why was it that they could never stop worshiping idols? I think it just never stopped. Two generations at best, and then they're back to worshiping idols. What was it that captured them about idols? There's a lot to say about idols because an idol was made for the rain, an idol was made for fertility. There was an idol for everything that you wanted in life, and so they would go and they would worship these idols. And, there was something there, but I think the thing that drew them, and this is just me, I think the thing that drew them as much as the idols was the atmosphere at the temple. Because if you think about it, in the Old Testament, where were the nightclubs? They didn't have nightclubs. They didn't do that kind of stuff. They didn't have nightclubs, but they had idol temples. And at the idol temples, you had the prostitutes. You had crazy music. You had the people having a good time. You had the drugs. You know, you say, where were the drugs in the Bible? Drugs were all over the place in the Bible. In fact, usually the word witchcraft or sorcery, not all the time, but the vast majority of times you see in the Bible, witchcraft or sorcery, put this up. See if you recognize this Greek word. Pharmakia. Yeah. Witchcraft and sorcery was the mixing of medicines to help you escape the situation that you were in. In fact, in Homer's Odyssey, which was written, I think, the 8th or 9th B.C., you've got, who's the gal? Helen Troy. And Helen Troy is mixing some stuff up for her friends, and she says, this will help you forget your troubles. You got it way back. You got Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 19, and it's telling you the roots you can't have in your house because you can't be messing with these roots. Those were the drugs. And so what you had at the temple, you had the prostitutes, you had the partying, you had the witchcraft, i.e. the pharmakia. And to some degree, I think that's what was drawing them back. I think it was the idol. But I also think that it was a party lifestyle. These were people that worked hard. These were people who worked in fields. It was very difficult for them. And where do you go on the weekend in Israel? There's nothing to do unless you go down to the temples where you got all the stuff going on that you can find on a Saturday night down in Knoxville. And it seems to me that that's the thing that continually drew them back. They could not break free of that kind of lifestyle. They just couldn't break free of it. Now you say, well, that's drugs, that's sex, that's, you know, maybe alcohol. I mean, sure, those things enslave you because there's a physical reaction and there's things that happen. And so those things can enslave you. But listen to what Jesus says in John chapter 8, verse 34. He said, most assuredly, saying, mark it down. I always speak the truth, but I'm speaking even more truth now if that was possible. Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. Now again, they were familiar with slaves. We're familiar with addiction. And Jesus is saying, whoever commits sin is an addict of sin. They become addicted to sin. And he's not nuanced there. He doesn't have clauses. He's saying that's just the way it is. Most assuredly, all sin leads to addiction. All sin has you saying, I'm not polluted. I don't have a problem. And it ends with you saying, I can't break free. There is no hope for me in this situation. Why? Because all sin bears the marks of addiction. there's, when people talk about addiction, there's varying signs of addiction, but there's always about four. What is there? There's a crisis, or there's a situation that causes them to seek comfort in this act or this substance. So there's a crisis that develops, and they seek some comfort, some salvation in that. And out of that crisis where they seek salvation in that, you have the increasing of tolerance. You need more and more to get the same effect. You have denial, and it then leads into this self-feeding spiral that leaves you in a very bad position. So you take pill popping, right? Why do people take pills? Why do people take their drug of choice? Usually it's a crisis. Usually there's a depression. Usually there's a tragedy in the family. Usually there's a physical pain, and they're trying to aid that or to lessen that physical pain. But something has happened in their life, and they're trying to fix that problem or that pain with this substance or with this thing. And what happens? Tolerance develops. You need more and more to get the same effect, right? You keep needing more and more because your body's getting adjusted to it, and so you need more and more. And of course, there tends to be denial. Everybody talks about denial. I really don't have a problem. I could stop if I wanted to. This really isn't a problem for me. And then, of course, it evolves into the self-feeding spiral. And that means that you reach the point in your life when you're trying to fix the problems created by the drugs with drugs. In other words, the drugs got you into this problem, and somehow you're trying to fix the pain that comes with the problems created by the drugs with more drugs. And so, if it's a pill, that has relational implications. It's starting to cost you in your relationship. Maybe there was a stress that caused you to begin to start to take that pill, but now it's causing relationship problems in your life. It's causing moods in your life. It's causing issues at work in your life. It's causing you financial stress. And so the drug is creating more crisis in all the major areas of your life. And how do you deal with the crises that are coming in your life? How do you escape all the crises at work and the relationships and the finances? How do you deal with that? You go take more drugs. The crises were created by the drugs, and now you're escaping from the crises created by the drugs with more drugs, and it's this spiral all the way to the bottom where something's got to break. Something's got to give. That's the essence of addiction. But again, listen, all sin is addiction. I mean, take something like lying. Say lying's not an addiction. I can stop anytime I want. Well, let's go through this. Why do people lie? Well, at least in the beginning, they lie to get out of a problem. There's a crisis that has developed in their life that's probably going to get them spanked. And the lie is a way of getting out of this crisis. What happens when you're 20 and you're still lying? Well, you're not lying to get out of crisis. It's now you got a tolerance for it. You're lying to get a job. You're lying to get a girl to go out with you. You're lying about your money. You're lying about a lot of stuff. You're just not lying to get out of crisis. You're just lying about a whole lot of stuff. And the lies continue and continue and continue till it may start small and it may be attached to the crisis. And you say, I'm just going to lie to get out of the crisis and then I'm going to stop. But now you're lying about a lot of different stuff that aren't even crisis related. And of course, there's denial. I only met one guy in my life who said, I'm a no good, dirty liar. Most people don't lie. There's denial. The reason I lie is because they can't handle the truth. I'm not really a liar. I do it to spare people's feelings. You can't tell people what you think of them, that you'll hurt their feelings. Yeah, there's the lying. There's the denial about the lying. And is it self-feeding? Is it a self-feeding spiral? Of course it is. Because what happens? The lies get you into trouble. And how do you get out of trouble if you're a liar? You tell more lies. That's how you get out of trouble. So the lies create problems in your life. And what are you saying? I didn't lie. Of course you lied. You're trying to get out of the lie by telling another lie. It's a self-feeding spiral. Now that's the very definition of addiction. When you're trying to fix a problem with the thing that got you into the problem, you got a problem. Take materialism. Is it that way? Of course it is. That's an easy one, right? Why do people become materialistic? Usually there's a lot of deep-seated unhappiness. There's a lot of unrest in their life, and materialism comes into their life as a cure for the unhappiness and maybe the depression that's in their life. Does tolerance happen with materialism? Yeah, because you got to have more and more and more. It might have been the three-wheeler, but now it's got to be the four-wheeler, and then it's got to be this and that, and it's got to be a bigger TV, and it's got to be more. And we used to spend this much at Christmas, but now we're spending this much. And we used to be able to spend the money that we have, but now we spend the money that the credit card will loan to us. And so there's this tolerance that's going, and you need more and more to get the same effect. Is there denial? Man, I'm just living the American dream. I don't have a problem. I work hard. I spend hard. I don't have a problem. I'm rewarding myself for my hard work. There's no issue here. Well, you owe more than what you have sold would bring you. You got negative net worth. Of course there's an issue here. Does it self-feed? Yeah, because materialism brings its own problems. Materialism, you find out, doesn't help the emptiness. It, in fact, creates more emptiness, because what you find is that all the things you thought would fix it, you're still lonely, you're still bored, you're still depressed, and now there's a sense of hopelessness, because what is it that we can buy that's going to fix my unhappiness? And as you're buying and buying, you're just making it worse, and you're trying to spend yourself out of the depression that the buying and buying continues to bring into your life. It's a self-feeding spiral. Take something like pride. You say pride can't be an addiction. Pride is an addiction. You know where pride comes from? Most people who have issues of pride that we would say, boy, they're a very, very proud person. Most of the time, pride comes into your life because you got a very fragile self-image. You really don't think much of yourself. In and of yourself, you don't feel like you're worth a lot. And a lot of that probably comes maybe from your childhood, where maybe you weren't treated the way you did. There wasn't positive reinforcement in your life. And so you're not the kind of person who can say, you know what, I know what I'm good at, and I know what I'm bad at. And if you can tell me one thing I'm bad at, I can tell you 10. I'm okay with that. I've come to accept the fact that I'm not very good at a whole lot of stuff, but I'm good at some other stuff. And so I'm okay with that. And beyond that, you know, my self-image is built on the fact that Jesus Christ died for me. I was worth so much that Jesus Christ died for me. So go ahead, shoot. Because my self-image is sort of based on the things I know that I can do well and on what Jesus Christ thinks of me. But people who are proud haven't reached that point. And what happens with pride, and the reason people who are proud also have this deep sense of inferiority, when you talk to people who are proud, you also say, are they proud or are they inferior? I mean, do they have a high self-image or a low self-image? And the answer is, it depends, because what happens is that in and of yourself, you don't feel like you're worth anything. And so where do you get your self-worth? By comparing yourself to others. And when you think that you're doing better, or when they're bragging on you, or when you're getting positive feedback from them, or when you size yourself up and you're winning, you're very, very proud. When you size yourself up and you're losing, out comes all of that inferiority. Because it comes from comparison. When you're up, you're doing well. The pride comes out. When you're down, that inferiority comes out. And that's why when you see somebody with pride, It all depends how they're doing in life. They can be the most obnoxious person in the world, or they can be the most self-pitying person in the world. It all depends what day you catch them on as to how they're sizing themselves up. But that's where pride comes at. Does tolerance happen, though, with pride? Does the need for more affirmation, does the need to win, does the need to feel better about yourself through constant comparison to others, does it get worse in life? Of course it does. Of course it feeds. I mean, if you're a kid and you're 8, a sticker on your homework once a week will probably do it for you. But when you're 18, you got to win at everything. I got to win at everything. When I'm 30, I got to hide all my flaws. I've got to act like I'm perfect when I'm not. When you're 8, the sticker works. But because you have this endless inferiority inside of you that you have to keep covered up and you keep looking for reinforcements and through comparison, that's where your self-worth comes from. That thing grows and it grows and it grows in your life. The tolerance just gets out of whack. Now, is there denial? Of course there's denial. I mean, how many people say, you know what, I've got a very fragile self-image, and in and of myself, I don't feel competent, and my life really isn't built on Jesus Christ and what Jesus Christ has done for me, so I spend my whole life comparing myself to others, and I try to set it up in a way where I'm always ahead of them so I can always feel good about myself, and that's essentially why I'm obnoxious, and that's my problem. Of course there's denial. Does it self-feed into a spiral? Of course it does. And here's why pride always self-feeds into a spiral. Because pride destroys relationships. You know the one thing you gotta have if you're gonna fix broken relationships, and we all have conflict, we all have relationships in our lives that have to get broken. Relationships reach that point where they gotta get fixed. Things got said that shouldn't have got said. People got taken for granted that shouldn't have got taken for granted. Things happened that have to get fixed, or the relationship can't continue. And you know the one thing you gotta have to fix a broken relationship? Humility. Humility. But here's the thing that happens with pride. The pride, the arrogance, the constant need for attention, the constant need for affirmation, the inability to take criticism because criticism cuts you to the bone, and because you're very fragile. What that does is it creates its own relational problems. You're very hard to live with because you can't take criticism, and you're always putting yourself higher, and you get very hard to live with. Because you got pride, you can't fix it. And you get into conversation, you're sitting there with your wife, and you know you messed up, and you know she's better than you, and you know that you got to humble yourself, and how do you fix the conflict? You buck up. It's like, well, you're as bad as I am. I didn't say, you know, maybe you misheard, maybe you don't hear so well, maybe I speak okay, but you can't hear. You ever think about that? You know, and what is that? That's the pride. That's me doing anything I can not to humble myself because my ego can't take humbling myself in front of my wife and saying, I really messed up. I'm a terrible person. Would you ever consider forgiving me? And it just feeds. It just feeds. The pride gets you into problems, and then the pride comes in and keeps you from fixing your problems, and it keeps driving people away from you. It's an addiction. One more. Take unforgiveness. Is unforgiveness addictive? Yeah. Where does unforgiveness come from? It comes from a crisis. Somebody's wronged you. Somebody's hurt you. There's a crisis in your life, and out of that comes unforgiveness, which begins to take root, to shape into bitterness, and then from bitterness into hate. So that comes up. Does unforgiveness have a tolerating effect? Yes. Sin generalizes, but no sin generalizes more than unforgiveness. And what that means is that it grows and attaches itself to things that were not part of the original situation. So, if somebody wrongs you and you refuse to forgive them and you hold that, something's going to happen very quickly. You're going to begin to dislike their friends or those that are supportive of them. It's just not going to be about them, but it generalizes. You just don't have a problem with them. You got a problem with all those who, quote unquote, supported that person or who doesn't see them for who they really are. And it's just not them. It generalizes quick into their family, into their friends, and it's growing. It's like an oil leak in your life. And this is another version of tolerance. And, you know, if somebody wrongs you and you never forgive, you can end up hating a whole race of people. It just keeps growing. It just keeps generalizing. I'm a preacher, right? I know a lot of people that don't like preachers. And if you go back into it, there was a preacher who did them wrong, and they never forgave about it, and they never forgave it, and 30 years later, they hate every preacher. It generalizes. I got an uncle who's a plumber, and as I recall, I think it was this cable that went out. So he's a plumber, and he calls, and he's trying to get the guy to come out. I think the guy was supposed to come out and fix it, but he never showed up, so he's calling, and he's trying to give the person down the road for, you know, they stood him up, you know, he lost a half a day work and all that. And he starts talking to this woman on the phone about his cable going out and the guy not showing up. And the woman says, "Well, what do you do?" He says, "I'm a plumber." And she said, "Oh, plumbers. Yeah, plumbers. You guys never show up. I mean, plumbers, come on, you never do the job right." And she still goes off on this tirade about plumbers. And he's saying, "Lady, it's about my cable, not my occupation." And, I mean, he touched a nerve. Some plumber did her wrong and now she hates them all. Sin always generalizes. If you don't forgive this person, it jumps in circles. It hits their friends, it hits their families, it hits everybody that's like them, it hits everybody that smiles at, I mean, it just keeps going, and the hatred keeps flowing in your life, and the bitterness keeps flowing. Of course there's toleration. You need, your appetite grows. Is there denial? Oh yeah, there's denial. Listen, I forgave, but I didn't forget. You know what? I should hate them, but they're not worth my time. Of course there's denial. And does it self-feed? Of course it self-feeds. Because again, the unforgiveness, it cuts into many things. One area it cuts into is your relationships, because as that bitterness grows. I mean, have you ever been around a person who has just eaten up? What happens? Can I be honest with you? You think twice about taking their calls. Because I know what this is going to end up with. They're going to talk about the weather and how the Cowboys played, and then we're going back to that same thing, and they're going to talk it through again. You just get tired. It starts to infest the conversation. They can't let it go. And you know what? When you start to back up from that, you know what happens to you? You go on the list. You're sympathizing. You don't even care what they did. They've done a terrible thing to me. And so the unforgiveness creates relationship problems, and it keeps creating relationship problems. And in response to all the people that don't want to hear it anymore, that are backing up on you, what do? They go on the list. It keeps spiraling down, and the unforgiveness just keeps going circle by circle in your life. All sin is addictive. All sin. Jesus said it. All sin. Anybody who commits sin, who goes down that road, who doesn't stop it, who doesn't repent, who doesn't fix it, all sin ends up making you a slave to itself. It spirals you down, and for the life of you, you can't break free. You keep saying, "This is the last time I'm ever going to watch something like this. This is the last time I'm ever going to smoke something like that. This is the last drink I'm going to have. This is the last time I make that mistake." You keep saying that and saying it and saying it, and you find out that it's hopeless for you. You're like Israel. It's hopeless. To my idols, I must go. John chapter 8 verse 36 says, But who the Son has set free is free indeed. Who the Son sets free is free indeed. Jesus is saying, you're going to get enslaved by that thing that you've allowed to grow in your life that you didn't repent and fix and bring to the Lord in the beginning. But the Son can make you free indeed. Now that's how that happens is a long subject. So let me just cut to the chase. Let me just go to the last point of probably 5 or 6 points of how Jesus makes that happen. And here's how he does it. Here's the principle. You know how you fix an addiction? You got to get addicted to something else. The only way you can fix one addiction ultimately is to get another addiction. Thomas Chalmers, who, and I think I've read this to you, but I think it's the greatest quote on addictions I've ever read. He was the greatest Scottish preacher in the 19th century. And this is what he says. He's very holy. He's very bright. He's thought this through. And I believe this came from the Lord. He said, it is seldom that any of our taste, bad habits, or flaws are made to disappear by a mere process of natural extinction. In other words, he's saying all your stuff doesn't just go away. It is very seldom that this is done through the instrumentality of reasoning. In other words, you're a bright person and you're trying to think your way out of it, but you can't think your way out of your flaws and your addictions. It is almost never done by mere force of mental determination. He's saying, you got a strong will, that's fine, but your strong will is not going to dig you out of the hole you're in. He said, but what cannot be destroyed may be dispossessed. You may not destroy it, but you can dispossess it. You can put something in its place. There's not one transformation where the heart is left without an idol. In other words, he's saying, you're going to worship something, and what you worship is what you're going to be addicted to. The heart desires for one particular object may be conquered as to its desiring for having some supreme object that is unconquerable. The only way to dispossess one affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. What's he saying? He's saying if you really want to break your addiction, you got to find a bigger addiction, and that's Jesus Christ. That's the Son of God. That's the Son of God. My father grew up, and I talked about him, I think, maybe last week. My father grew up in a really dysfunctional household, and there's a lot of violence and there's a lot of drinking and I think I mentioned last week how he would put my grandmother up against the wall with a shotgun in her mouth and the kids are there and watching this. And so it was a very terrible place to grow up. And there were 6 kids in that family. 6. And the family coming out of that environment just really exploded. And so 2 of the daughters, there were 4 girls and 2 boys. 2 of the girls became alcoholics. And I think one has passed away. We lost track of her several years ago. But, they basically threw their life away on alcohol. The 3rd sister became a very, very angry person and carried tremendous anger rooted in her childhood, her whole life. And she basically drove everybody who cared anything about her out of her life. And she passed away. She was 62. She died of Alzheimer's. And I'm not sure that if the anger and the stress of all that maybe furthered that along. We're just not sure. The 4th girl spent her whole life going from one man to another. And she lost track of the relationship she had. So of the 4 girls, 2 were alcoholics. 1 was an extremely angry person who died very early and very alone. The other one went from one man to another her entire life. Dad's only brother died in his mid-40s from AIDS. He basically threw his life away on sexual pursuits. And then there's Dad. 2 alcoholics, 1 very angry person, 1 girl chasing, love wherever she could find it. The other one threw his life away on sex and died very early. And then there's Dad. And I remember one of my aunts saying, and she said it sort of flippantly and off the cuff. She was naming all the things that her, the family had gotten involved, all the things the kids had gotten involved in. And she said, and Ron, well, Ron found Jesus. Ron found Jesus. That's my dad. And she meant it as an insult. Some found alcohol, some had sex, and Ron found Jesus. You know. But I thought about that. And that's true. Ron found Jesus. The other ones found drugs. Some found sex. Some just buried up in anger until they were all alone. But Ron, my dad, he just found Jesus. And the thing that happened, he came out of that family, and he was very much like that family. He ran away from home when he was 15. He got married when he was 17. He was violent. He only tried to beat up my mom once, but she was a little bigger than he was. She came up and she clawed him to death, and he never tried it again. But he came out of that family. He was a drinker. He was a womanizer. And then when he was 23 years old, he was working on a rice dryer in Arkansas. He was working third shift, and he had to stay awake on third shift. And so he dropped by his in-laws, and he was trying to find something to read that he hadn't read. And he grabbed a storybook of the Bible off the table. And by the time he read that book to the end, he was on his knees under the stars outside, and he had given his life to Jesus Christ and had never been in a church up to that point, but he just came to Christ through a storybook of the Bible written for kids. And it completely changed the trajectory of his life. And he became very radical. If you'd have known my dad, he was a very radical guy. He had to be in church 3 times a week in all the revivals. He tells about his car breaking down, and he drove to church on a flat tire about 5 miles, tying up traffic, but he didn't want to miss church, and he didn't want to take the time to change the tire. He's 23. He had an incredible work ethic. Had a house, 2 cars, motorhome. He was doing very well. He was a supervisor. And they came in and said, "You're going to have to work Sundays." And he said, "No, I don't work Sundays. That's for Jesus." And they said, "Well, you can't work here." He said, "Okay, then." He quit that job in Bradford, Arkansas. He started driving to Little Rock, which was 60 miles one way. And we're talking about the 60s. Those weren't great freeways. 60 miles one way, he was making 1/3 of what he was making before. By the end of the summer, he had lost everything, and he was living with a wife and 3 kids in that camper behind his in-law's house. Now, you say, that was a bad decision. Maybe it was, but he got radical. He got radical. And I think in his mind, he said, "I'm going to end up like everybody else in my family if I don't get addicted to Jesus. It's got to be about him. It's got to be about eating, sleeping, drinking Jesus. It's got to be about worship. I'm not going to stay saved if I'm not in church on Sunday. I'm not going to stay saved. I'm not going to stay committed if I'm not there every time pushing, driving, pursuing Jesus Christ." But he got addicted to Jesus. And so you can break your sin, but the power of sin is broken when you begin to think about Jesus more than you think about your sin. If you start to think about Jesus more than you think about drinking, if you start to think about Jesus more than you think about sex, if you start to be craving Jesus and thinking about Jesus more than you're thinking about all the people that's done you wrong in your life, you're going to be able to break that power, because that new addiction is going to supplant the old addiction. But it doesn't begin with a prayer. It begins with saying, "Listen, Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He came from heaven to earth. He died for me. He gave his life for me. That's how much he loved me. He deserves everything in my life. And my only chance of being free in this life from downward spirals is to become addicted to him." The great thing about that is he doesn't spiral you down. He spirals you up. As your tolerance for him grows, he keeps spiraling you up, and you find that you're free from the things that everybody else can't seem to break free from. You find an ease in breaking free. Why? Because you got this massive addiction that's just taking over your life. That's the only way we break free. But who the Son makes free, who the Son sets free, is free indeed. Nobody else can do that for you, but who the Son sets free is free indeed. Listen, who the Son sets free is free indeed. Have I told you guys who the Son sets free is free indeed? You can be free if you want to pay the price, and the price is giving your life to Jesus. I'm going to give my life to Jesus and then I might come back to church in 5 months. Well, that's fine, but that's no addiction. That's no addiction. And not much going to happen there. Not much going to happen there until you begin to pursue Jesus more than you pursue the things that have you bound. You got to pursue him more than you have him bound. You can't think about drinking for 10 hours a day and say a 2-minute prayer and get anywhere. You got to think about Jesus for 10 hours a day and drinking for 2 minutes a day. But you need the new addiction in your life. Will you stand with me?